Hello and welcome to a new and special series of NASS podcasts on equity, diversity, and inclusion, or EDI, within school psychology. I am Shayla Desai, the NASS Director of Educational Practice, and I'm honored to be the host of this series. Today, I will be joined by guests Dr. Celeste Malone, Dr. Chavez Phelps, and Dr. Dave Schreiberg. For this first episode, we'll be providing an introduction and overview of the series and discussing the integration of EDI work in different career stages. We will also discuss the recently released NASP anti-racism resolution with the writing team co-chairs, Dave and Chavez. With that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Celeste Malone. I'd love for you to say a little bit about your role and also if you can go into how this series originated.
Hi, and it's a pleasure to speak with you, Shayla. I'm Celeste Malone. I'm a member of the NASP Board of Directors as the Strategic Liaison for Professional Information Services and the Board Lead for the Social Justice Goal Team. I'm also currently chairing the NASP Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, EDI, Implementation Task Force. The idea for the podcast really originated from the EDI town hall that this task force held back in February during the convention in Baltimore. The attendees had a great desire for more events like that, where they could really sit down and talk about EDI issues within the profession of school psychology and within NASP itself, because they felt that there was never any type of forum to do so. We saw more desire for those type of events when NASP held the anti-racism town hall during the summer of 2020, did that virtually in response to our nation's reckoning with issues around structural racism in response to the murder of George Floyd and countless other Black people. We had record-breaking attendance and registration for that town hall. And that was also followed by high levels of participation in a graduate student survey asking about their needs to help their programs deal with issues around anti-racism and promote that. So based on all of this interest, we wanted to have an ongoing way to discuss these issues. And we didn't get to address all of the questions that were submitted in advance for the anti-racism town hall. Even for the questions that we did address, we could have easily spent an hour or more, had a whole town hall dedicated to each one of those topics. So consistent, kind of like an offshoot of the earlier podcast special series that NASP did in, I think, 2016, 2017 with the Social Justice Task Force, we discussed doing something similar as a way to bring these EDI topics to school psychology, really with a lens of looking in the profession itself, as opposed to solely looking outward on diversity issues in pre-K through 12 settings.
Thanks, Celeste. Could you talk a little bit about what we'll try to cover in this series? I know we won't be able to get to everything, but we've talked about how this might be the first season of several. So what will we focus on in the upcoming episodes?
Fingers crossed it's the first season of several, because I think that there's so much that we could potentially address. Our starting point for this season were the leftover questions from the anti-racism town hall, the ones that we didn't get to. And we wanted to make sure that we covered a broad range of topics with EDI as related to school psychology, graduate education and training, professional issues, as well as professional practice. Within graduate education and training, we'll have topics related to racial climate and school psychology programs, engaging in best practices for multicultural and social justice training. How can we improve and help school psychology faculty be better prepared to address these issues within their coursework and navigating with students, increasing their cultural responsiveness, as well as supporting international students? Within professional issues, there's a great deal of interest in diversifying our school psychology leadership pipeline that came up during the EDI town hall, the anti-racism town hall, and the themes from the graduate student needs assessment. And navigating the profession as a member of a minoritized group, how do you deal with microaggressions that may occur within professional settings, workplace, and in the university? And with regards to professional practice, some of the issues that we hope to address this season are talking about the root causes of disproportionality. So a deeper dive into the role of implicit bias, racism and other systems of oppression and how they manifest in inequity in school-based outcomes, as well as promoting anti-racism practice in early childhood settings. We're not limited to those. I'm hoping that members chime in whether via email or on NASP social media about other topics that they would like us to address.
Thanks, Celeste. And that's a lot that is going to be covered. I'm wondering, as the chair of the EDII task force, how you're hoping that this content can kind of push school psychology forward.
I think it allows us to hold a mirror to ourselves. Issues around diversity, multiculturalism, and social justice haven't been as much in the forefront of school psychology as they have been in comparison to related professions. And I think about social work, counseling, and counseling psychology. They've been talking about diversity, multicultural, and social justice issues for years. NASP has made significant strides in that domain, but from my experience and then doing the work of the EDII task force as well, when we talk about issues of diversity in school psychology, we talk about what we need to do in order to serve the pre-K through 12 students, that school psychologists need to be aware and practice from a culturally responsive and socially just lens because of these inequitable school systems. But there's very little reflection, insight, or discussion about how this applies to the field also. So it's always been about what others need to do as opposed to what we need to do as a profession and how the lack of diversity has impeded our progress in this area. For example, we often talk about the lack of racial and ethnic diversity within school psychologists. It's been a long-standing issue. Even though we've had our first position statement on that topic in the 80s, we've had very little growth. And then when we look at the research or any publications talking about the lack of racial ethnic diversity and what we need to do for recruitment, it's still very externally focused. Oh, people aren't applying to school psychology programs. People of color don't want to be school psychologists, but without any type of thought or reflection, is there things within our field that are off-putting to individuals of minoritized groups that lead them to go to other fields outside of school psychology? And so we put the blame on the lack of diversity in the profession to minoritized individuals, or placing the blame on them without really considering what is our role in that lack of diversity. And so what I'm really hoping is that as we talk about these different topics, we see that social justice, diversity, multiculturalism, anti-racism, we need to talk about them so that we're prepared to better serve kids, but it's also applicable to the field itself. That don't go to a training around microaggression so that you don't microaggress against the kids in your school, but then go ahead and engage in microaggressions against colleagues or graduate students. That whatever we say about social justice externally very much applies to us also. And so I hope that this podcast series will shed some more light on it, and then also get us thinking about what we could do differently as a profession in applying these social justice tenets to our own work.
And a final question for you, Celeste. We're wanting this EDII podcast series to focus on equity and diversity in the broadest sense, so various aspects of diversity, not just race. But can you talk a little bit about how racism underlies all inequitable systems and why that we kind of start there?
Sure. I think it's an important starting point because racism has been embedded in the fabric of this country since its founding. And it undergirds every system of oppression that exists. And so, yes, we recognize that racism is not the only oppressive force that's enacting within our field. But we can't talk about oppression in this country without considering the role of racism, and in particular, the role of anti-Black racism. When we look at the role of race in predicting outcomes, we see it with regards to infant mortality rates, maternal mortality rates, educational attainment, lifelong earning, health outcomes, as well as life expectancy, all of which could be predicted based on race. But the reason why we could predict all of these different outcomes is because racism has permeated every aspect of American society. And we see it very much so within our educational systems. So thinking about how schools were segregated by law for many years and how people of color, particularly Black individuals, were deprived of the right of education or any type of knowledge. That changed with the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which eliminated legal segregation based on race. In later episodes, and I'm sure Dave and Chavez will talk more about, even though Brown eliminated legal segregation, we still see racism play out in our systems. But nonetheless, it set the tone that you can't discriminate based on individuals' identity. And that was a court decision based on race, and it laid the framework and the foundation for us to make progress on addressing other areas of oppression. So Brown versus Board of Education, that case law and decision led to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It also influenced the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's laid the foundation for gay rights as well as transgender rights and equality. So when we get race right, because it is so prevalent and pervasive in our society, racism rather, is so prevalent and pervasive in our society, when we get that right and make efforts to dismantle racist structures, it does lead to us tearing down the walls of other systems of oppression. And so it's an important foundation for us as a profession to address and to recognize that. Also, when we look at other oppressive systems, such as ableism, such as sexism, such as heterosexism, a lot of discussion around those tend to be, or rather, they tend to eliminate people of color. And so by understanding racism, it also allows us to look at other oppressive systems from an intersectional lens. Because even when we think about individuals with disabilities, they have poor outcomes in many areas compared to non-disabled individuals. But when you add the layer of race onto that, racially ethnic minoritized individuals who are also disabled have worse outcomes than white disabled individuals. And so race should always be a part of our conversation whenever we're looking at any systems of oppression. And that will help us, I think, progress as a field, lay the foundation for us to tackle other areas within social justice and the equity framework.
Thanks, Celeste. That makes a lot of sense. Really appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your knowledge with us. I'm going to shift now to Dr. Dave Schreiberg and Dr. Chavez Phelps. If you could both just briefly introduce yourself and share a bit about your roles before I go into a few questions. We can start with Dave.
Sure. First of all, I very much appreciate being invited on this podcast. I just want to echo what Dr. Malone said, and that I hope that this is the first of many podcasts that NAS does on this important topic. And it's, I've been in the field for about 20 years, and I consider it one of my career highlights to have been included in this. So I very much appreciate that. In terms of my background, so I was a practitioner for 3 years, but in the last 17, 18 years, I've been a professor of school psychology. And I'm the professor and program chair of the school psychology programs at Indiana University. Social justice has been a major focus of my teaching and research for the past 10 or 15 years. And right now I'm a member of NASA Social Justice Committee.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me as well. I'm so honored and humbled that you would invite me to be a part of this. My name is Chavez Phelps, and I'm assistant professor of school psychology at Indiana State University. I'm in my fourth year. Prior to entering the academy, I was a practitioner for a little over 7 years in New Orleans, where I focused primarily on supporting students with significant social emotional needs and really thinking about it from a public health perspective. In terms of addressing the lack of care, equitable care, and evidence-based care that the students were not receiving, and they they should have been receiving justly. So thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to being a part of this.
Thank you both for being here. So I wanted to start with asking you, how can EDI become part of the fabric of school psychology rather than existing in a silo? And why is it so important that we make sure that this work is integrated in everything that we do?
Well, you know, I would say Celeste made a good point that we have to really do the introspection and the reflection. I'm noticing in many of the conversations that I'm having, that's missing. And the more that we can encourage people to really reflect on their own implicit biases, thinking about how these issues have impacted them and maybe how they have contributed to these issues is really important. I'm a part of a few book clubs where we're reading books such as How to Be an Anti-Racist. And what I'm finding is that often people are, when they're reading such works, they're thinking about it like, oh, other people who have done these things are not doing these things, instead of thinking about, you know, how have I not been anti-racist? And what do I need to do? And I think the more people can have those honest reflections with themselves, I think the more we can be able to integrate this social justice within the fabric of our field. One of the other things that I think is so important and NASP is doing is providing, I was so excited when the NASP standards, the revised NASP standards, social justice is infused in those standards. And so that provides a guide and a foundation for members and training programs and in the profession at large to know how to do this work, how to engage in this work in terms of not just thinking about social justice as a process, but social justice in action. So I think that's really important.
Thanks so much, Chavez. Anything to add, Dave?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Chavez just said. I guess I would add, as speaking as a white cisgendered male and as a person that's privileged in just about every category, that well, I think it's what he said is important for anybody, but I think particularly for those of us that have privilege and are not having these like day-to-day lived experiences where some of EDI issues may just become incredibly apparent, that it's even more, I think their onus is even greater on people in privileged positions to be consciously thinking about equity, both in terms of ourselves and our own biases, as I said, and also kind of what's happening in the system around us, the public school system, universities, wherever we might work. And in terms of why this is so critical, I think schools are microcosms, public schools are microcosms of society. The things that are happening in society, good and bad, just and unjust, those are happening in schools. So for me, that's part of the beauty of working as a school psychologist and the big reason why I went into the field. So we can do our own self-work, which is really important, but we also need to be looking critically at what's happening in our school. There's no school that's perfect as relates to EDI. In my experience, is almost every school I've ever encountered has numerous areas for growth as relates to EDI. So we are not working in a vacuum. Wherever we're working, these issues are playing out. So we need to be cognizant of it and be kind of advocates for change.
I think Dave makes a good point. I'm sorry, I think Dave makes a good point, because this work cannot just be the responsibility of people of color. And so often I've noticed, I've been in conversations or meetings where folks are trying to put that work on folks of color. It's like, no, we all should be doing this work as a collective. And if we don't, then it's going to be very difficult for us to truly integrate it into our profession.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that those are great points. You know, the burden has to be shared with everyone in order for this to be effective. So I want to talk a little bit about how this work might look a little different in different parts of a school psychologist's career, starting with graduate preparation. So what are your thoughts on how this work can look like for graduate students, and also from the graduate coursework aspect, how can this be infused so that we're instilling these values and priorities in the newest members of the field.
So I'd like to answer this from a couple perspectives. One is from a student perspective, and then I think you're also asking about, like, as a professor or as people that are creating the graduate climate, what that's like. So from a student perspective, whether you're entering graduate school in school psychology as a 22-year-old right out of undergraduate, or someone who's been in another career for a period of time and shifting into school psychology, graduate school is when you're being socialized into school psychology and what the profession is all about. And so I think about it kind of from a developmental perspective. These are your early experiences in terms of what the field is about, what we should be doing as school psychologists, and what kind of constitutes the core of our knowledge. So for you as a student, I think it's really important to be asking questions, developing self-awareness, as Chavez spoke to before, and being really critical consumers of the program you're in. If you're applying to graduate school, looking critically at those programs and what they're saying, what they're not saying, whether the commitment to equity is just something they put on their website and doesn't seem to have more substance, or whether it's a program that's really substantively thinking about equity and diversity issues. Once you're in the program, you know, you're looking at yourself, you're looking critically at the schools that you're working in. Depending on the program you're in, you may be in a climate where you can speak up. Other programs that may be a little harder, but be aware of kind of what's happening to you, and not letting yourself be socialized into a world where EDI issues just are part of the conversation. Because frankly, in some graduate programs, my sense is that could easily happen. The other thing that comes to mind for students is to find others who share your passion. So often at NASS conferences or just interacting with graduate students, I'll hear students say, I think I'm the only one in my program that feels this way, that's passionate about equity and social justice. That may or may not be true of your program. I think increasingly that's less and less true of any individual program, but there's a national network of graduate students, of faculty, of practitioners that really do care about EDI. And I think finding your community, hopefully within your program, but then nationally through the NASS community areas, through social media, through your state organization. I just think for students, it's just vital to have others that are kind of on this journey with you. From the perspective of training, and I'll turn over to Chavez in just a second, I do think it's really important for faculty to be very cognizant of what they're doing. If they're doing the same program that they were running 20 years ago, they're not very unlikely to be talking about EDI issues. And I think, like in any other world, like it's very easy to fall into ruts in academia. The academic space doesn't usually be all that inviting. It's very likely a very white space. So I think you need to be very cognizant, not just of like the one equity course that you might have, but thinking about your program culture as a whole, and what messages are we sending to students? How are our courses talking about equity? Is there sort of a coherent vision? As Chavez mentioned, are we putting all this on one faculty, typically a faculty of color, to kind of cover everything? Or is it truly integrated across your program? I think training programs, for the most part, are just starting to think that way. There's some exceptions, of course, but I think in general, that a lot of programs, my sense is, like, to the extent they're thinking about it, it's put on one person, typically a person of color, and that's what we need to change.
Well, you know, I would add, in terms of from a student perspective, I think joining some of the, like, the social justice interest groups or the advocacy interest groups that NASS offers, where you can have a sense of community and you can learn from others and really have deep conversations about these issues around social justice, I think it's really important. Finding those groups on your college campus that might be addressing social justice issues or issues around diversity or multiculturalism, I think is really important. And from a faculty or a program perspective, I think it's really important that faculty make sure that it's a part of their mission. Like when someone goes to your website, they can see that social justice is a part of your mission. So anyone who's interested in your program, whether it be a student or a prospective, a new faculty member, someone who's applying to become a part of your faculty, they need to see that. They need to know that is important to you. One of the things I've also noticed, and I keep going back to this is that also faculty need to really engage in deep self-reflection. develop cultural humility. I think that's really, really important to think about. How are we treating our students of color? Are we being fair and just? How do we talk about our students of color compared to our other students? Thinking about our admissions process or requirements, right? I don't think we should have GRE as a requirement for students to get into a doctoral program or a specialist program. The reality is that GREs, they tell us, scores tell us nothing about how well a student will do in a program. And we know in terms of students of color may not perform as well on these sort of standardized tests. So when we have that as a requirement, then we're creating barriers for students of color to be able to enter the profession. I think that's really important. I definitely agree there should be some foundational courses in social justice and diversity and equity issues, but it should be integrated throughout the program, throughout the courses. It should be integrated in the field-based experiences that we provide for our students. You know, many of our students at Indiana State University, they're no longer staying near the institution. They want to be in major cities. So we need to prepare them to be able to work in such cities so that they can do their work. We should be creating social justice agents who are going out there who are going to promote equitable practices and services for students and families.
Thank you both. Yeah, those are really great points. I want to ask now about what this work can look like for practitioners in the field. So as students get out there and even for seasoned practitioners, what do you think are maybe good places to start with EDI work? Just any thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is a question I've been thinking about a lot. When I do presentations, that's probably the number one question that gets asked. So we're in a moment right now, whether people use the language of social justice, equity, diversity, inclusion, or a lot of people now have this language maybe that they didn't have before, or if they did have it, they're more sort of overtly saying like, yes, I'm for social justice, or yes, I'm for diversity, inclusion. When I do trainings on social justice, sometimes I'll ask, you know, raise your hand if you're for social injustice, right? So like, no one's gonna raise their hand. So to me, like, I think some people have the idea that if they just kind of say that they're for these things, that they've done that's it, that they've done the work. And I think I'm thinking particularly, I guess the people that I know that tend to fall in that category tend to be sort of white, well-meaning. And that's probably captures a lot of our field. Our field's very white. And I like to think that anyone in school psychology has good intentions for their work. And they're not consciously trying to harm anyone. But to me, that's the bare minimum, saying that you're for social justice and that you're for good outcomes. Like, that should be like the floor of the work that we're doing as practitioners. Where I think it becomes really important is, but that kind of to take the next step is to take some personal responsibility and look critically at the work that you are doing. School psychology is a beautiful profession in the sense that, like, you don't enter school psychology unless you have a desire to help others, right? I mean, we're in the middle of our admissions process. And so I've read all kinds of essays for people applying to school psychology, graduate programs, well background. They all want to be helpful. And for me, one of the biggest learnings for me, again, as a person of privilege, is that I think I once thought that if I wasn't consciously harming somebody else, which I never, of course, tried to do, that therefore I was a part of the solution. That's not enough. Like, I would hope that no school psychologist is trying to consciously harm anyone. But if you're passive, if you're just kind of, if the work is just kind of saying that you're for something, but you're not actually changing the practices, and you're not kind of doing the work to look critically at what you're doing. Am I microaggressing? Am I, you know, am I harming other people even though I don't intend to? I think for a lot of school psychologists, myself included, that's kind of the biggest step, is kind of being able to step outside of yourself and know that you're not consciously trying, in most cases, consciously trying to hurt people. But you might be, either by your actions or inactions And if you're not working on some level to get at the injustices happening in your schools, whether we're talking about disproportionality in school discipline, abuses of special education systems, positive behavior supports, any area that we work in, we're going to find that power is being abused and people are being harmed. So if we're not speaking out and using whatever power and resources we have at our disposal in our work to address those kind of root causes, we're falling well short of our ability as school psychologists to bring about change. So I think that kind of initial awareness is important. It's also really important that we don't stop there and we think about how do we translate that. And then how that happens, I think, is very specific to where you work, because different schools will have different realities, but just kind of being cognizant of like the status quo is unjust. I don't want to be a cog in that status quo. And that's going to involve looking beyond the surface of what's happening, including what I'm doing, and at least being open to the idea that even though I'm not consciously trying to harm people, my actions or inactions may be harming others, and I need to be accountable for that, as well as, of course, working to hold other people to account for things that they're doing, and then working collaboratively and using our database decision-making skills, our collaboration skills, to move from an unjust situation to a just outcome.
I agree with everything Dave has said, but in addition to that, I really believe that practitioners should be looking at their work from an ecological perspective, right? And thinking about the various systems in which children operate within, understanding how policies and procedures for schools and school districts can impact students and families and the work that they do. We have an ethical responsibility to promote evidence-based services and supports for students. So we should be advocating for MTSS, like multi-tier systems of supports, and making sure that schools are implementing such a framework, a system based on the evidence. I'll give you an example. When I was a practitioner, you know, many of the schools were working really hard to implement MTSS, but if the student has a reading comprehension problem, but you're constantly only providing a basic reading intervention for students, you know, that's not socially just. And so that's something that, you know, we have to speak out when we see such issues to make sure that students are getting the supports and the services that they really need. I think it's important also as a practitioner to get involved with your state association, where you're able to promote and advocate for statewide policies and regulations that actually are good for students, good for families, and also, you know, speak out when there are legislation being proposed that might not be in the best interest for children and for families. So I think that's really important. As you can see, I'm sort of an advocacy person, so that's sort of my approach to think about the policies and the laws and those procedures that can truly impact students and making sure that we're advocating for those policies and laws that are good for all students, that create not just equality, but equity for them.
That's a really great point, that there's work to be done at the individual level, at the school level, at the state level, at the federal level, and that all has to work together to ensure that we have equitable systems. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I also wanted to spend some time talking about the recent anti-racism resolution that the two of you chaired. Thank you so much for all of your work on that. Could you just take a few minutes and give some highlights of the resolution as a starting point?
Well, I think first I want to thank the team that we worked with. We had a great team that that helped us to develop this resolution. It truly was a collective effort. And I think that is a testament to what this work should look like. Social justice work should be a collective effort. I think we really wanted to make sure that the resolution made it highlighted an urgency for this work. And so we wanted to make sure that people, when they read this document, that we we saw that this is work that truly needs to be happening now. One of the things we wanted to do was acknowledge that while NASP has done some great things over the years in terms of equity and diversity, but that we do have a history that we had to own. And that's a part of sort of organizational sort of reflection, right? That we haven't always gotten it right. And that we needed to acknowledge that. We wanted to make sure also that the resolution sort of hit certain areas. So thinking about what individual school psychologists could do, what we could do as a profession, what can happen in terms of policies and legislation, and then also thinking about what training programs can do to promote anti-racism action.
Yeah, I would agree. I think for me, one of the parts that was most powerful, and I was not the author of this, an excellent graduate student, Adriana Crossing, wrote a lot of this part, so I want to give her credit for that, was looking at kind of acknowledging that, again, while I think school psychologists really go into the field with all the best of intentions, that the history of our field has not always been on the side of justice, right? We can look at any number of practices on the special ed realm, disability realm, discipline, where we may have, perhaps unintentionally, but the contribution of school psychologists as a field hasn't always been a net positive. We've caused harm. Right. Now, again, not on purpose, but that's and I don't think there are too many documents put out by NASP or Division 16 that have just kind of acknowledged that basic reality. So again, it wasn't intended to like point fingers at any person and say that people are trying to harm, but I just think it's important in our field to have both some statements about what anti-racism could look like. And there is a lot of that about what NASP can do. And I particularly like the parts or appreciate the parts where we talked about centering BIPOC voices. And this is, as Chavez mentioned, like really his area of passion, where we started talking about like legislative advocacy and kind of how our field can be more united as a force for good. But I just felt like it was particularly important to acknowledge that we're not perfect. Our history has not been perfect. I think sometimes we tend to see ourselves as like kind of the heroes of the story as school psychologists. And there are so many school psychologists that are fantastic heroes. I love school psychology, but I think it's important for us to have a balanced and clear look at our history if we want to change our trajectory in the future.
Also, I like we wanted to provide some basic terminology. We thought that was really important, especially like defining what is racism, right? Because we constantly have that conversation in our society about what is racism, right? And everyone has often have a different perspective on that. Interestingly, I was just in a meeting having a conversation with colleagues and talking about, well, what is racism? And someone brought up this, you know, the notion of reverse racism, which does not exist, right? And so, you know, someone made the signal, well, we're just splitting hairs on this. No, we need to be very clear about what we mean when we are talking about racism. So I really appreciated that section of the resolution, so that we're all on the same page and we have a foundation for where we can go with this work.
Thank you both. And you've talked about this a little bit, but I'm curious what you both see as some of the biggest challenges in our field when it comes to being anti-racist.
So I think there's several. We've hinted at kind of Dr. Malone talked a bit about the lack of diversity in our field. So just because you're a white female or white, which is the majority of our field, doesn't mean that you can't be strong in equity, diversity, inclusion. But it does mean that you're less likely to have life experiences that will highlight quite clearly and vividly the inequities that exist in our society in a day-to-day way. So I think just kind of the lack of diversity, and then within that, the lack of influence of our BIPOC leaders, which it's my sense is that's really changing in the last few years. But if we talk about it kind of more from a historical lens and kind of where we are as a field, we have not done a good job at all of recruiting, supporting, mentoring for diversity. And then of those in the fields, we have not elevated the voice of BIPOC scholars. The other thing that I think is another thing that I would highlight As I said before, I think school psychologists, myself certainly included, we tend to think of ourselves as the good people, kind of like the heroes in the story, because that's why we go into the field. No one goes into school psychology to do harm. Something that I think is a little, can be a little counterintuitive to white liberals such as myself, and that's how I classify myself at least politically, is that I think there's a tendency for persons that are white. There's research in this area. And then I think if you ask any person that's BIPOC about this, they, every person I know can then rattle off a number of direct experiences of this, where white liberal, white progressive can be some of the most harmful people in promoting equity, diversity, inclusion. So I think there are a lot of white practitioners in particular that think that they're on the side, that want to be on the side of good, that think that they're creating a positive force, but what they're really doing in a lot of cases is microaggressing and harming the same people that we're trying to, that they're saying that they're trying to elevate. And I think one of the main reasons why that happens, and again, there's increasing research, the work of Paul Gorski in particular has been quite strong in this. If it becomes about making yourself feel better, it does feel good, or at least for myself as a white person, it feels good to feel like, okay, I'm on the right side of this. And I do, I'd be lying if I said I don't get some personal gratification out of feeling like, okay, my work related to this, like, is something that I can feel good about. But that's not the reason to do it. And I think there's a lot of people that there's a certain element of like wanting, whether it's performative or wanting to kind of show on the side, but then in the process, making it all about yourself and your feelings and getting into groups and trying to dominate discussions with your BIPOC colleagues about what should happen. So I think to come back to what Chavez mentioned about cultural humility, I just think that there's a lack of that collectively that I see, including amongst people. So I think overt attentions is to be helpful. So I think you just need to be, we need to be careful that in our enthusiasm for promoting social justice, that we're not making it as persons in privileged categories, we're not making it about themselves and feeling better, but we're truly centering the experience first and foremost of kids. And then within the profession of those that have been marginalized and professors. And frankly, and it means like, if you have ideas, share them, but for the most part, like, shut up, listen, like, don't be, if you're in the privileged category, you're probably not the person that's in the best position to advocate for how power and privilege can be changed. And so I think we need to make sure that white, not only that we diversify the field, but the persons that are in positions of power have a certain amount of humility and are truly centered on elevating the voices of others as opposed to making themselves, you know, feel or look good.
I'll just add a few more statements because Dave, you nailed it. My biggest concern is that it just being performative and people not really serious about truly doing the work. I do think that there are many folks who understand social justice as a process, but not necessarily as an action, right? And so what does it mean? And I think making sure that we provide the folks in our profession with the tools to be able to really go out there and do this work, right? To actually do it in action and not just as a process. I will agree also, one of the other challenges is making sure that folks who are in a position of power, that they're doing this work not to or for people of color, but with people of color. And I think that's really important. Over the summer, lots of organizations and institutions worked really hard and rushed. We need to respond to what's happening not only in our larger society, broader society, but also what's happening at our own institutions. And I think there was a rush for those who were in positions of power to just do something without necessarily working with people of color to make sure that it actually addressed the needs that needed attention. So.
Thank you. So I do have one final question, and I'd like to open this up to Celeste too. What gives you hope for the field and making progress in this area?
I'll take your silence as the invitation to respond first. But I think about graduate students as well as early career school psychologists. the demographics of our graduate students, there's far more racial and ethnic diversity within that group. So there's about 29% racial ethnic minoritized school psychology graduate students based on our graduate program data. And then when we compare that to NASP data, it comes into about 12 or 13%. So our field is becoming more racially ethnically diverse, though the change is slow going, but I think it's ramping up. And then even aside from the increased diversity, a greater attention and desire to talking about social justice issues. And that's propelling the field to respond, that we can't be stagnant anymore because our graduate students and our early career professionals are pushing us to respond and answer to some of the inequities that we've had a hand in perpetuating, that we need to do something different. And we're at a decision point in our field where we need to change so that we do become more inclusive and keep those racially, ethnically diverse and social justice oriented school psychologists in the field. Either the field changes or we lose them. And I really think that the field is going to change due to the influence of these new professionals. And it's exciting to see that grow.
Yeah, I would agree. Sorry, would you like to? I would agree. I think the students and the younger professional, not that people that are older don't have important things to contribute. I do get the sense that a lot of people that have been in the field for a while are looking at what they're doing with different eyes, at least within academia and professors. Like I'm part of a work group of white faculty that are trying to be more cognizant about anti-racism, and I couldn't even imagine something like that happening even like 2 years ago. So I do think that there is growth amongst people that have been in the field for a while in terms of thinking about this, but by far I think the thing that gives me the most hope is the people entering our field, both just the increased diversity and also just kind of the mindset. I think so much about this work, I think, is as much about having a mindset as a skill set. And you know, for example, you know, 15 years ago I can remember teaching classes and like the concept of like LGBTQ marriage was controversial, right? And now it just like, it isn't. Like I think our students, I mean, not, you know, all the students I have, like it's sort of like there's more of a mindset for them. And like, well, why would people that are LGBTQ not be allowed to marry? Like, it's just not even like a point of like debate anymore. And it's happened in a relatively short period of time. And so I've just kind of seen our students' kind of attitudes really changing over time. And I think that increasingly students are pushing their professors and new professionals are pushing their schools to think in different ways. And I think that's where the change is really going to come. Again, we don't want to be on the side of harming other people. And I think that there is kind of an increased recognition that that's been happening across the board. But what gives me the most hope is just the next generation and the newest professionals that are really emerging and have been pushing our field in really good ways.
I agree with both Celeste and Dave. I'm noticing in my classes now, students are asking certain questions because they want to know, they want to do better. Dave and I did a presentation on social justice, I believe in November, and many of my students attended because they wanted that information. They truly are. They have a desire to truly be social justice agents in this work. Also for me, once again, because I'm a huge like legislative advocacy junkie, is I'm truly excited about this new administration. I think with the synergy with NASP, our federal policy platform, a lot of that is about really addressing some of these issues that create inequities in our schools and in our society. So I'm really excited about what the next 4 years can bring in terms of this work that we do, because we have sort of the ears of this administration who want to know what we're doing as school psychologists to promote the profession, to promote anti-racism work within our schools. So I'm really excited about that.
Well, thank you all. This has been so helpful and informative. I want to thank all of you again, Drs. Malone, Triberg, and Phelps, for being part of this introductory episode. To everyone listening, thank you so much for taking the time and especially for taking an interest in these critical issues. We'll look forward to the rest of the series and hope you'll tune in next time when we'll be covering welcoming, affirming, and inclusive pre-K to 12 schools. For more information on EDI topics and social justice, please check out the NASS website. Thanks and take care.